It is now 3 o'clock.
Good evening, I'm Jim Lehrer. On the NewsHour tonight, the news of this Friday. Then a newsmaker interview about Iran's nuclear program with its UN ambassador. A NewsHour report on the election year challenges facing Republicans. The weekly analysis of Mark Shields and David Brooks. And a media unit look at the new 9/11 movie about what happened on United Flight 93.
Major funding for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer has been provided by...
The world's demand for energy will never stop, which is why a farmer is growing corn, and a farmer is growing soy, and why ADM is turning these crops into biofuels. The world's demand for energy will never stop, which is why ADM will never stop. We're only getting started. ADM, resourceful by nature.
There's a company that builds more than 1 million vehicles a year in places called Indiana and Kentucky. One that has 10 plants from the foothills of West Virginia to the Pacific coastline. What company is this? Toyota. A company that, along with its dealers and suppliers, has helped create hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs. A company proud to do its small part to add to the landscape of America.
And by Pacific Life, CIT, and the Atlantic Philanthropies, and...
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
The deadline for Iran to stop enriching uranium came and went today. The UN Nuclear Agency reported Iran had defied demands to freeze its nuclear program. We have a report narrated by Jonathan Miller of Independent Television News.
The 30 days Iran has had to answer questions has just left more questions unanswered. This, the verdict of Mohammad El-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who says Iran has failed to come clean. There remain, he says, too many gaps in his agency's knowledge for him to assess whether Tehran really is bent on building a bomb. That its enrichment program is moving steadily proves it's ignored the UN Security Council's demand that it stop. A copy of the unpublished report has been obtained by Channel 4 News. It confirms Iran's claim this month to have enriched uranium with a cascade of centrifuges to the level required to fuel nuclear power plants. The agency is unable to make progress, it says. Those knowledge gaps a matter of concern. This afternoon, the report's been sent to the UN Security Council, some of whose members are talking tough. This morning, Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, pouring scorn on the UN. Iran doesn't give a damn about such resolutions, he declared. The bullies of the world won't dissuade us. Amid the shrill rhetoric, stakes high, tensions ratcheting up.
In Washington, President Bush said the world was united and concerned about Iran's moves. And at the UN in New York, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton said the Security Council must act with a sense of urgency.
The point, and there's no question about this in our mind, is to enhance international pressure on Iran to show just how isolated they are, to show just how unacceptable is their pursuit of nuclear weapons. There is still time for the government of Iran to reverse the strategic policy that it's pursuing of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. We're prepared to continue to work in the council, but certainly not for an unlimited period of time.
The U.S. and several allied nations favor moving on sanctions against Iran. China and Russia have said they'd oppose that. We'll have excerpts of President Bush's remarks today and an interview with Iran's UN ambassador right after this news summary. The U.S. State Department today cited Iran as the leading state sponsor of terror. The finding was part of an annual report. Among other things, it said Iran has helped insurgents in Iraq with planning and roadside bombs. Overall, the report tallied more than 11,000 terror attacks around the world in 2005. About 3,500 happened in Iraq. Another U.S. soldier was killed by a roadside bomb in Iraq late Thursday. That made 67 Americans killed in April, the worst month this year for U.S. forces. Since the war began in 2003, nearly 2,400 U.S. troops have died. More than 17,700 have been wounded, mostly in combat. Today, Iraqi troops battled insurgents in Bakuba for a second day. Officials said nearly 50 gunmen and 7 soldiers were killed. U.S. Senate leaders talked of up prospects today for a new compromise on immigration reform. Majority Leader Bill Frist indicated they're making progress. Minority Leader Harry Reid said they hope to have an agreement by Memorial Day. They spoke as immigrant groups planned a national economic boycott on Monday. They're urging Latinos to stay away from work and school and to take part in rallies. President Bush said today he does not support the boycott. He was also asked about a Spanish language recording of the national anthem being released this evening.
There is a version of the national anthem in Spanish now. Do you believe it will hold the same value if sung in Spanish as in English?
No, I don't. I think the national anthem ought to be sung in English. And I think people who want to be a citizen of this country ought to learn English. And they ought to learn to sing the national anthem in English.
At the same time, Mr. Bush did endorse again the idea of a guest worker program. The tensions with Iran sent oil prices up for the first time this week. In New York, futures rose nearly a dollar to settle near $72 a barrel. Also today, the number two U.S. oil company, Chevron, reported first quarter earnings surged nearly 50% to $4 billion. The president today rejected calls for a windfall profits tax, but he said the companies need to pour the money into finding more energy. The U.S. economy rebounded in the first quarter of the year. The Commerce Department reported today the gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 4.8% from January to March. That's nearly three times better than growth at the end of last year. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 11,367. The NASDAQ fell 22 points to close at 2,322. For the week, the Dow gained 0.2%. The NASDAQ fell nearly a point. And that's it for the news summary tonight. Now, an official Iranian opinion. Republican politics, Shields and Brooks, and the first big 9/11 movie. Iran's nuclear program and its UN ambassador. Ray Suarez has our story.
The UN's nuclear body, the International Atomic Energy Agency, delivered its report just as the deadline was passing for Iran to stop enriching uranium. The IAEA said gaps remain in the agency's knowledge. Therefore, the report says, the IAEA is unable to make progress in its efforts to provide assurance about the absence of undeclared nuclear material and activities in Iran. The agency concluded by saying it cannot make a judgment about or reach a conclusion on Iran's future compliance or intentions. This afternoon at the White House, President Bush was asked if the diplomatic options were dwindling.
No, I think the diplomatic options are just beginning. And as you might recall, about 6 or 7 months ago, you were asking me questions about the United Nations Security Council vis-a-vis Iran. And now we're headed to the United Nations Security Council. And I look forward to working with all interested parties to make sure that there's a common voice. Listen, the first thing that has to happen diplomatically for anything to be effective is that we all agree on the goal. And we've agreed on the goal, and that is Iranians should not have a nuclear weapon, the capacity to make a nuclear weapon, or the knowledge as to how to make a nuclear weapon. And now that we've got the goal in mind, we're working on the tactics. And today's IAEA report should remind us all that the Iranian government's intransigence is not acceptable.
The Security Council is expected to take up the issue of Iran's nuclear program next month. And now we get the official Iranian view from that country's ambassador to the United Nations, Javad Zarif. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador. Today was the deadline set by the IAEA for Iranian compliance, shutting down its enrichment. Did you respond officially to that request or simply ignore it?
Well, it's good to be with you and good evening to you. We said very clearly that Iran does not want to pursue a nuclear weapons program. It is not in our strategic interest. At the same time, Iran believes, and I believe the majority of the international community share this opinion, that in order for the international non-proliferation regime to be sustained, you need to respect the rights of member states. We made it very clear that Iran does not respond well to pressure, that Iran would cooperate if the cooperation takes place in an atmosphere of conducive to reaching substantive conclusions. I would like to point out that in September of 2005, before the series of pressures through the IAEA Board of Governors imposed by the United States started, the IAEA was reporting good progress being made in ascertaining the extent and context of Iran's nuclear program. We know that through our cooperation, the IAEA has been able to verify a good number of outstanding issues, and Iran has been prepared to allow the IAEA to reach a definitive conclusion on our program. Unfortunately, for some arbitrary red lines as well as arbitrary deadlines have been the order of the day, not to seek solutions, but in fact to push towards a crisis. And if a crisis is what they want and what they seek to achieve, unfortunately that would be the case. But we believe a crisis is not necessary, because we share the goal of the international community that no country should have nuclear weapons, and Iran certainly is a country that is committed to non-proliferation and does not want to seek or produce nuclear weapons.
Mr. Ambassador, you quote a 2005 report that cites good progress in the IAEA-Iran relationship, but today's report from the agency says that your country has curtailed its cooperation, made it very difficult for the agency to monitor your activities, and instead of shutting down enrichment as they requested, you've accelerated it. Is that true?
Well, in fact, we said that cooperation and confrontation cannot go together. Iran has provided a choice. If the United States and the Western countries cooperating with the United States are looking for confrontation, then they should not expect Iran to go out of its legal obligations to be cooperative in ways that it's not obliged to. However, we have said if the path of cooperation and reaching a resolution is chosen, then Iran is prepared to go out of its way, as it has done in the past. As you know, Iran has opened its doors to the IAEA, has allowed about 2,000 days of inspection in Iran in the past 3 years, allowed many visits even to military sites, which Iran was not obliged to do, in order to allay any concerns that our military sites had nothing to do with any nuclear program. We did all of that in order to show our willingness to adopt the path of cooperation. But unfortunately, since the Security Council adopted the presidential statement, it was very clear, and the report of the Director General makes it again clear, that Iran is prepared to cooperate, provided that the United States does not choose the path of confrontation.
Well, you've just described what you view as your country's extensive cooperation with the international community. What has the IAEA asked for that Iran has decided it is unwilling to give?
Well, basically, we are prepared to provide information to the IAEA to the extent that information is available. As you know, proof of a negative fact is impossible, but Iran is prepared. We have nothing to hide. Iran's nuclear program is exclusively for peaceful purposes, and we are prepared to cooperate with the IAEA. We have been prepared to cooperate with the IAEA in order to clarify that. If you look at the report of the Director General that was issued today, he once again indicates that there was no indication of any military activity in Iran, and he also indicates that Iran has officially informed him that it is ready to help him ascertain the outstanding issues and resolve the outstanding issues, provided that this issue is dealt with in the technical framework within which it should have been dealt with from the very beginning.
Recently, Iran confirmed that it refined a large amount of uranium to power plant grade. Your president, Ahmadinejad, announced that he'd like to continue research with even more powerful and sophisticated centrifuges. Would you accept the world's verdict that If you're not refining for weapons-grade material, you sure look like you are. That you're doing what countries who are preparing to get weapons-grade uranium do.
First of all, there is no world conclusion or any indictment by the international community that Iran is pursuing anything other than a peaceful nuclear program. The United States wants to repeat that often and in numerous circumstances in order to create an impression as if this was the case. Iran's program is exclusively peaceful. We have said that we will put a cap on the level of enrichment, as you said, to the reactor-grade enrichment, and that is quite different from what is required for illicit purposes of producing weapons, and that Iran has said very clearly that we're not interested in. In fact, Iran has made proposals to put into motion and put in place a good number of political, legal, technical, and monitoring mechanisms in order to verify that our program would remain exclusively peaceful, that the enrichment, which is our inalienable right, will not exceed the level that would be required for our reactors, and we have been prepared to go out of our way in order to provide these assurances. Unfortunately, the arbitrary red lines that have been drawn, which have no base in any international treaty or any international regime, and the IAEA is on record accepting that, have precluded the possibility of moving forward with these very substantive and, in fact, conducive proposals that have been presented by Iran as well as many other countries and non-governmental organizations.
Earlier today at the White House, President Bush said that his government and the world don't want Iran to have even the knowledge of how to make a nuclear weapon. If your program continues at its current pace, will you end up with that knowledge?
Well, I do not know what President Bush is talking about. Iran has the knowledge to enrich uranium. We do not want the knowledge to build nuclear weapons. Iran is opposed to nuclear weapons, and we have made that extremely clear. On the other hand, the president is not in a position to set criteria or guidelines for other countries. There are a body of international rules and norms. I know that the United States has no affinity to international law, but there is a body of international law which defines what constitutes legal activity in the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and what constitutes illegal activity, and Iran has been within its legal bounds.
Is there a legitimate concern on the part of the United Nations that a member state that has a head of government who's called for the wiping off the face of the earth of another member state, that it should be worried about their having a nuclear program?
Well, let's separate the two issues. First of all, as I have repeatedly pointed out, the Iranian nuclear program is a development program, is an energy program. It has nothing to do with security. It is a legal program. If you want to deal with the other issue, we have never threatened to use force against any other country. Our history, in the past 250 years, we have not attacked any other country. We have been the subject of invasion. We have been the subject of aggression. We have been the subject of use of chemical weapons. But we have defended ourselves, but we never resorted to use of chemical weapons, even in retaliation. So our record is very clear. On the other hand, unfortunately, Israel has a record of aggression against its neighbors, has a known nuclear stockpile, is not a member of any international instrument. The question that needs to be asked is whether Israel and the United States are prepared to make the same statement that Iran has repeatedly made, and that is, we have not and will not attack or threaten to attack another country. I wonder whether this statement can be made either by President Bush or any Israeli official.
Can you imagine a circumstance where you could make that kind of representation to the American government itself? Is it time for the United States to meet directly with Iran over the nuclear debate?
Well, the mechanics are not important. It is the political will of the United States, whether it seeks a resolution, whether it seeks to deal with realities based on mutual respect and to try to resolve outstanding issues and grievances between the two countries. If the United States reaches that understanding and is prepared to do that, then Iran will be a willing partner.
So, because recently there were supposed to be meetings over the future of Iraq, and those didn't take place. Would there be more to talk about, a more fruitful possibility in discussions about nuclear policy?
Well, Iran responded positively to a request that was made initially by the United States and then repeated by Iraqi officials that Iran should participate in bilateral dialogue with the United States on how to help the Iraqi situation and how to help the Iraqi people and government in stabilizing their country, which is, I assume, in the interest of the United States and certainly in the interest of Iran, which is a country in the region, did not come thousands of miles away from its shores in order to invade another country. But unfortunately, since Iran showed its readiness to engage in that dialogue, the attitude shown by the United States has been less than serious and, in fact, has made it very difficult for those talks to take off the ground.
Ambassador Javad Zarif. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
It was good to be with you.
Still to come on the NewsHour tonight, what now for Republicans, Shields and Brooks, and the United 93 movie. Gwen Ifill has our report on what faces Republicans heading into this fall's midterm elections.
Senator Wayne Allard chose a challenging moment to return home to southeastern Colorado for town meetings last week. The public's approval of Republicans in Congress and in the White House are at record lows. Time magazine just named Allard one of the nation's five worst senators.
I don't think they've been out and recognized what I do in the state of Colorado and the successes that I've had here.
While Allard is personally popular in this solidly Republican area of the state,
I'd like to thank you for all the hard work you've done for Colorado and southeastern Colorado.
The ranchers, farmers, and small business owners here are entering the seventh year of a devastating drought that is wiping out family farms and leaving empty storefronts in its wake.
I mean, it's just reckless. And it's a sad note when you have to discourage your kids. Don't get involved in agriculture because, son, I don't even know whether I'm going to survive.
Okay. Well, we'll head off to the next town meeting.
Allard heard these and other broader concerns in each of the small towns along his road trip last week.
The oil companies are making billions of dollars over what they have in the past. Yeah. So why isn't something being done to curb that? Because all it's doing is wrecking the economy, not only the United States, but worldwide.
As he met with the people who sent him to Washington, Allard tried to emphasize the good news, the energy, highway, and defense legislation that brought federal dollars home.
I'm kind of bullish about southeastern Colorado, actually. I think there's the economy is going to be doing better down here.
But the questions were plentiful and the answers scarce.
I think it's premature for me to take a position on it right now.
If you want an immediate solution, I don't know where we can get that.
I listen to what your concerns are. You share those with me, and then I'll file this all away.
But we found several of Allard's constituents still had more to say. Mike Donnelly owns a ranch outside La Junta.
I'm not in accord with him on immigration, in part. I've got some real issues with spending by the country and the government. Regarding the war on terror, I don't believe that we're really in a position to foster democracy in a bunch of cultures around the world.
Forrest Frazee is the sheriff in neighboring Kiowa County.
I think that the administration has been ridiculed on all those aspects, every one of them. He's had to defend the war. His administration has had to defend itself. Spending has been defended. Look at some of those primary initiatives we went into the new year with, has been dropped, a lot of things.
Sandra Leonard's son served in the first Gulf War.
I personally, as hard as this is for me to say publicly, I personally do not think that Iraq was the wisest thing for us to do. However, if we had to do it, I would have liked to have done it with accurate information. And I am not sure that that information was forthcoming the way it should have been.
In a year when alarmed Americans looking toward Washington see only trouble, immigration, gas prices, Katrina, Iraq, Wayne Allard is one of the lucky ones. He is not running for re-election this fall, but 246 of his congressional colleagues are.
Political analyst Charles Cook, who is tracking the ups and the downs of this fall's midterm elections, says Republicans are in grave danger of losing their majority.
Virtually every diagnostic indicator but one points to a gigantic tidal wave. I mean, these numbers are worse than 1994.
That was the year Republicans shocked the Democratic majority by seizing control of the House and the Senate midway through President Clinton's first term. This year, Democrats are actively coveting the 6 seats they need to win back the Senate, the 15 seats they need to claim the House. Political analyst Cook sees a perfect storm building.
It's like a million different things. It's, you know, high gasoline prices. It's Hurricane Katrina, Harriet Myers, Scooter Libby, congressional scandals, high budget deficits, immigration, port security, just sort of death by a thousand cuts. And not all of these things bug every single person. Different ones bug different people. But, you know, two-thirds of the American people are bugged pretty badly right now. When you're looking at the last two polls showing a presidential job approval rating of 32% and 33%, we're knocking on the doors of Nixon-dom. I mean, this is, this is horrendous. This is the kind of environment where you lose people that, you lose incumbents that nobody in a million years would ever thought could lose.
Democrats are attempting to seize the moment. This week, they jumped on the gas price issue.
We have two oil men in the White House. The logical follow-up from that is $3 a gallon gasoline.
And on Katrina.
The president and the White House were not sufficiently engaged when they should have been initiating an aggressive response.
And then there is immigration reform, which has split the Republican Party right down the middle. Back in Colorado, Frazee, the sheriff, has pulled over carloads of illegal immigrants on this stretch of Highway 287.
Right now, Kiowa County's got well over 500 warrants out for failures to appear. Many of these are illegal aliens. We'll get them in, they'll have accidents, we have to service that. We've got them in where they have run out of money to get where they're going. We service that.
But he thinks if they pull their weight, they should be allowed to stay.
I think that, wash my mouth out with soap, but I hope we do an amnesty program. We come back in, we get them all listed with the IRS, we get them all listed with the local agencies, and they start living and we start treating them like American citizens.
Allard disagrees and calls the amnesty argument a loser.
I think it'll reflect not only badly on the president, but I think it'll reflect badly on Republicans in the Congress.
Another problem for Republicans, government spending, perceived as so out of control that the president this week threatened to veto a bill to finance the war because it was overloaded with unrelated measures. Some lawmakers agreed with that.
Our children and grandchildren deserve for us to preserve the opportunities that we've had. We cannot continue to borrow money from their future standard of living so we can do what we want to do today.
But for many in southeastern Colorado, that may be too little too late.
I think the Republicans have lost their way. They were supposed to be the party of fiscal conservatism. They are not. If that's compassionate conservatism, I'm not in agreement with it. And in that respect, I suppose I've lost some faith in George Bush as president, because I don't think he has gone out of his way, particularly to institute any kind of fiscal discipline.
A word of warning aimed squarely at the politicians who need these Republicans most.
And to the analysis of Shields and Brooks, syndicated columnist Mark Shields, New York Times columnist David Brooks. David, do you see a Democratic perfect storm coming toward these fall elections?
Well, I notice at Republican headquarters they've got rubber walls. Everybody's on suicide watch there. I mean, it's pretty bad. You know, I suspect they'll lose the House and probably not lose the Senate. But I think the thing that really...
You think they will lose the House?
That would be my guess.
But it takes 15. They need to... Democrats need to gain 15,
yeah,
right?
Well, yeah. If you can't do it now, when can you do it?
Yeah.
So that's just my guess. But you know, I think comments made in that report are what's really killing them. Spending. I hear that everywhere. A lot of conservatives deeply offended the Republicans couldn't control spending and they ran up the deficits. And then the other issues that are just big are the immigration issue and Dubai. Little things like that. A sense of loss of control, loss of competence, loss of governing the way you're supposed to govern if you're a conservative.
How do you see it?
I agree with David. I think that if the Democrats can't win in 2006, now... First stipulation is that a week is a lifetime in
right,
politics.
This is not even May yet. We're talking about November,
6 months
right.
away, and you know. But
yeah, sure.
I think it is. As Republican pollster Bill McIntyre said, it's almost taking something miraculous to intervene to bail out the president. And essentially, what you have, in addition to all the problems that David defined, and the gas at $3 a gallon, and the war in Iraq bogged down, and the third anniversary, Jim, this coming Monday, of the president's mission accomplished, the end of combat, and when 140 Americans had died. And all of this converge, is that I think most of all, is the president's job rating has suffered, and that's... Off-year elections are essentially a referendum on the president. That's when the Democrats lost it in 94. It was a referendum on the first 2 years of the Democrats running everything, House, Senate, and the presidency under Bill Clinton. And I think the Republicans face very much similar, except worse, situation this time.
David, where does the gas price thing fit into this now? Is it a passing thing, or is this really go deep?
Well, you know, I guess it makes people upset. I mean, one of the paradoxes here is the economy is going great guns, growth 5% or whatever it is, and yet people think the country's headed in the wrong direction. So the question is why? Obviously, the fundamental thing is Iraq. But then Iran, I think the sense that we're losing in Iran, but also the gas prices are clearly part of that. I happen to think what's happening on Capitol Hill is people behaving clownishly. I'm afraid they don't know how clownish they look, that they actually believe what they're saying. That terrifies me. Just let's face it, they're diagnosing a problem incorrectly. They're offering solutions that are silly. And they're behaving like people who are panicked.
Give me an example of each. The wrong diagnosis and a bad solution.
Well, the reason we have high gas prices is because of China, because of Iran risk, and because of this transition to ethanol. These are serious substantive things that it's hard to do a quick fix for. And everything that's being proposed, whether it's the oil reserve, whether it's windfall profit tax, whether it's in reducing environmental regulations,
What about the $100 rebate for everybody?
Well, that's stupidity on stilts. I mean, you know, that's a parody of stupidity. And so it's they're behaving in a panicked way. And at some point, I don't care what you're upset. We're all upset about gas prices, but you want to see your leaders behaving responsibly. So they're pandering. I don't think it does them any good, personally.
Doesn't do them any good, Mark?
It doesn't do the Republicans any good, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Democrats can pander, but the Republicans can't?
The Democrats have more credibility on being critical of oil companies. Just came out, Congress Daily published the top 10 recipients of oil company from the top 10 oil companies, from Chevron, which reported $4 billion today, and Exxon, which reported $8 billion in quarterly profits yesterday. And they were four Republican senators, Conrad Burns of Montana, George Allen of Virginia, Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas, but the others were all Republican chairmen. Denny Hastert of Illinois, big oil state, Tom DeLay of Texas, Bill Thomas, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. So when Republicans start railing, and George Bush see him as a born-again populist now, talking about we got this price gouging, it's a little bit like Henry VIII talking about monogamy. our liberal Democrats saying we've got to give the electric chair to pornographers. You know, I mean, yes. it's not quite credible.
But oil companies are not the problem either. I mean, Exxon, you know, these companies have profits like 7, 8, 10% of revenues. That's a perfectly normal profit range. Yahoo has profits of 45%. Plenty of Apple, 25% of revenues. It's not like runaway profits. That's the fundamental problem. Again, it's China and it's Iran risk.
When you see the median income of the country actually dropping Median household income dropping, and people have to live in places like Burke, Virginia, 35, 40 miles from their job, and they drive 35 miles each way, each day. All of a sudden, that trip has cost them $15 in gas. And they see $400 million golden parachutes for the company that looks like a direct pass-through, David, to the
right.
oil companies.
Well, there are two things I'll say about the oil companies. Yeah. First, that $400 million compensation package is just infuriating. I almost want to see Exxon get punished just so that no company does that again. And that's one issue. You know, nobody should make more than $390 million. That's my rule. but then the profits, that's a totally different issue. And to me, that's a silly issue. The fundamental issues are what's causing oil prices to go up. And the fundamental solutions are long-term solutions, trying to get better batteries in cars, and that sort of thing. It has nothing to do with anything that's being talked about in the near term.
Well, speaking of that, do you think because all the emphasis is there and the big spotlight is there and the politics is all there, that something's actually going to happen about this?
No, I really don't think something's going to happen. Something's going to happen in immigration.
Yeah,
but I don't think.
But I'm talking about.
I know you are.
Gas price.
Yeah, and I don't. I really don't think something's going to happen here. I mean, I think it's a terrible issue for the Republicans going in the campaign of 2006.
But aren't they going to push hard for this program yesterday?
But,
who knows?
I mean, but they're going to talk about CAFE raising the standards
for gasoline mileage.
The president, you know, was quite boastful of the fact they raised it for minivans and SUVs. We used 140 billion gallons of gasoline in this country last year. That saves 10 billion, the changes they made over 10 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about, 3 hours driving just outside of Green Bay. I mean, so we're not talking major.
And you used to feel the same way. There's no reality here on the table.
Right. I mean, the gas price, they could pass whatever. The gas price will probably continue to go up as the summer season comes along. So if people are upset and if they're going to blame government for higher gas prices, which I'm not sure they will, then that's bad. But, you know, gas and energy as a whole takes much less out of people's pocketbook than it did in the 70s and 80s. Mm. I'm always struck by how people panic over gas prices. Housing prices shoot up. Nobody runs to the government, and they take up a much bigger slice of the American public. But psychologically, I guess gas is.
Iran, what is your level of anxiety as a result of what happened today? And we just heard the Iranian ambassador to the United States.
With Ray, yes.
Yeah, with Ray.
Yeah, and say that they had no belligerent intention and no hostile intention, no military intention. I think it'll go to the UN, Jim.
How did that strike your ear when you heard him say that?
I thought he was, he was far and away the most rational spokesman for the Iranian regime that I've heard, either in person or in print, in quite a while. So
his rhetoric is slightly different than that of the president
of
Iran. Yes,
certainly. He is the diplomatic corps, I'd say, all by himself. But, I think we're going to a reality of the United Nations Security Council, and France and the Great Britain are with us, and Russia and China aren't.
Yeah. How do you see it, David?
Well, they're winning.
Iran is winning.
I think that's why they've ramped up the rhetoric, because this is a good battle for them. It raises their profile domestically, stirs up some national sentiment, raises up their profile with the Arab world, because they are standing down the United States. We've offered carrots and no sticks. We're having a real tough time getting any sort of coalition together. They're marching along, and, you know, we can't stop them.
What do you make of the ambassadors? He said it 3 or 4 times. He said, hey, look, if they just turn down the rhetoric and take the pressure off, we don't want to have a bomb, we don't want to have this problem, leave us alone, everything will just be fine, we'll bring in the inspectors and everything will be hunky-dory.
Right. Well, I think it's completely untrue. But I was struck that he used this theme, let's not have a confrontational attitude.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder what that theme is all about. Maybe it's the idea and playing to the idea in the United States that most of us don't want a confrontation, especially with Iraq going on. There is a tremendous desire not to get into another confrontation. So I think it plays well here. It's untrue, though.
I'm not an Iranologist. I guess they probably
sounds good to me, Mark.
But I thought it was particularly deft on the ambassador's part, I have to be honest, was he said, we make a pledge not to invade any hostile act against another country. Will the United States or Israel do the same? Well, the United States invaded Iraq, and Israel attacked Iraq. And I just wonder if this was an overture to their colleagues in Iraq. I mean, as a way of saying, hey, we're not going after you. The other guys that have gone after you, these two fellas, do you want to be on their side?
Also completely untrue, by the way. I mean, they fund Hezbollah and everybody else who's bombing people all around the world. They've bombed people in Paris themselves.
And there was, of course, a report today that Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Two quick things before we go. First, beginning with you, Dave, the Karl Rove CIA leak thing. Anything there to talk about?
Well, the thing that strikes me is how confident he was a couple months ago that he was not being indicted. Confidence that clearly was unmerited. I don't know if he will or not be, but clearly the confidence that it was all behind him, is it was misplaced.
Fifth time before a grand jury. Don't know anybody for whom that's good news. I mean, you go back and you run the risk each time of saying something different from the time, contradicting yourself, and he still, to apparently, according to those sources of Fitzgerald, Patrick Fitzgerald, has not satisfactorily explained the miraculous memory he had about his conversation with Matt Cooper of Time magazine after first not mentioning it and then recalling it miraculously.
Quickly, the coming of Tony Snow as presidential news secretary, is that going to be a big change we're going to see?
I'm a Tony Snow fan. I like Tony Snow. I think he's a very able guy. The press secretary for any White House, Jim, is the public face. And Scott McClellan had become a melancholy, defensive, sort of talking points bound face. I think Tony Snow will bring a certain panache and dash and some intellectual vibrancy to it, and we'll see how long it lasts.
Intellectual vibrancy on TV. It'll be a unique
what do you
experience.
Think,
no, I agree. I like Tony Snow quite a bit. He's a genial, very upbeat guy, very optimistic guy. And I think the other thing it signifies about the White House is the power of Josh Bolton now. Changing things.
This would never have happened, you don't think?
Well, I don't think so, but I think there has been a gradual opening up. They've done a little better of opening up and talking to reporters, and I think Tony's part of that.
Does it change the... I mean, Tony Snow comes from the outside. He's not... He worked for George W. Bush's father, but he's not an insider per se.
Right, and as everybody's pointed out, he's been quite critical on the certain things, and he's got a lot of credibility with Republicans, which will help, but...
Yes, he does. And Jim, going in, he said, I not only have a seat at the table, I have a voice at the table, which means he's going to be a participant in the councils that make policy.
Okay. Speaking of policy, we're through. Thank you very much. And finally tonight, Hollywood tells the story of United Flight 93. Jeffrey Brown has our media unit look.
Amid the horrors of September 11th in New York and at the Pentagon, the plight of Flight 93, the hijacked jet that crashed in a western Pennsylvania field, received the least attention until now.
United 93, runway 4 left, clear for takeoff.
Roger that.
The film United 93, released nationwide today, is a real-time dramatization of horrors and heroism. Viewers watch as one by one, people on board and air traffic controllers on the ground realize they've become pawns in the terrorist plan.
The target for American 11 just disappeared. There he is right there, over the Verrazano Bridge.
Word of the attack spreads through the cabin of the San Francisco-bound flight.
Just go after me!
And then the passengers decide to take action.
Well, it'd be nice for you to come back and see.
British director Paul Greengrass shot United 93 with long stretches of unscripted scenes featuring some amateur actors, including actual air controllers involved that day.
That was like the last straw. That was how it went down.
Greengrass explained that from the beginning, this flight was different.
The extraordinary thing about Flight 93 is that it was very late. By the time that Flight 93 took off, the other aeroplanes were reaching their targets.
In fact, the film United 93 arrives with its own questions of timing. The 9/11 attacks and their aftermath have been addressed in several books, in music, and in two movies on cable TV. But United 93 is the first major studio feature to deal so directly with that day.
It's about whether it's the right time, and it's about whether the families of those people on board the airplane want you to tell that story.
Of course it's too hard, but it's too hard for us every day.
Monday night's premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival in Lower Manhattan attracted many of the victims' family members. Melanie Homer's husband, Leroy, was the co-pilot of Flight 93. Sandy Dahl's husband was the captain.
I don't know how you can ever be ready for something like this.
Jack Grancolis lost his wife, and unborn child.
If people want to learn more about the events, that they should see the film. If they're not ready, then they shouldn't go. It's by no means entertainment.
A former United Airlines manager said he wasn't ready to see the film.
It's only been a few years, and it almost seems like Hollywood is trying to profit from this.
This weekend, Americans will use their wallets to judge whether now is the right time to visit that day. Later this year, two more major motion pictures on 9/11 make it to the big screen, all before the fifth anniversary of the attacks. And to look at some of these issues, we turn to David Edelstein, film critic for New York Magazine, and Wheeler Winston Dixon, author of the book Film and Television After 9/11. He's the James Ryan Endowed Professor of Film Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Welcome to both of you. Mr. Edelstein, the question that has been raised is, are we ready for big Hollywood movies about 9/11? What do you think?
Well, I think, like it or not, the events of 9/11 have permeated the culture. I mean, you see them in novels written after that point. You see them in television shows. You see them in other movies. One could argue that Syriana and Steven Spielberg's Munich were direct responses to 9/11 and attempted to frame the argument in a certain way. I think we're as ready as we'll ever be.
And you're the one among the three of us who's had a chance to see this new movie, United 93. How did it walk the line between honest drama and the feared sensationalism?
Well, it's actually extremely unsensationalized. I mean, in fact, it's almost more chilling when the director takes it, you know, to a slightly lower key than you expect. To me, there's nothing more haunting than the sight of air traffic controllers staring at a screen, at a little white icon of a plane on a screen, and not getting any answer. And that's all we see of it. But we know what's happening, even if the controllers don't. So that's about as unsensational as you can get. Also, the murders of passengers and flight attendants and the pilots are very much done in the margins of the screens. It's almost merciful the way the director works very hard not to brutalize you with the violence. On the other hand, you are brutalized by what you're watching, because this director, Paul Greengrass, began in documentaries. He made a sort of quasi-documentary called Bloody Sunday, which was a sort of recreation of a very famous Northern Irish civil rights march that ended in a massacre in 1972. And so he does this movie almost as if it were a documentary about the events of 9/11.
So, Professor Dixon, as Hollywood starts to tackle this subject, what concerns do you have about it?
Well, I mean, listening to David's description of the film, I'm kind of pleased that it doesn't take the sensationalistic angle, because, you know, in addition to the other work that you described Mr. Greengrass doing, he also did The Bourne Supremacy. And so that sort of gave me pause. But I think the main concern, of course, is that it's going to become commercial and sensationalistic and go for the violence and basically treat it as one would treat a traditional disaster movie. And that, I think, would be most unfortunate.
Do you think that movies on this subject should be held to some higher standard?
Unquestionably. I mean, this is one of the defining moments of the 21st century. I mean, it's the 21st century of Pearl Harbor. And hopefully we don't have any more like these coming down the pike. But I think that what's happening now is that these films, and they're going to continue to roll out, because Oliver Stone is working on one now that's going to take place in the World Trade Center. As these movies continue to roll out, I think that they must be held to a higher standard, because to trivialize these events would be to make light of one of the most serious political and social events of the 21st century in American society.
And Professor Dixon, you have been documenting movies and TV since 9/11. What have you seen? How has it impacted that art form, even in films and TV that is not explicitly about those events?
Well, I've seen, first, when after 9/11, right after it happened, there was more or less a summit meeting that was held in Hollywood, which was called by Jack Valenti, and also then all the major studio heads attended, basically saying we're going to cut back on violence and we're going to, you know, go for a more escapist fare. And that only lasted for a couple of months. And there were films like Collateral Damage that were pulled, the Schwarzenegger vehicle, and there were a couple other films that were shelved. But then, in the midst of all the escapism, there also came to be some extremely violent movies came back to the screen. And in fact, I think that we're seeing two strands. We're seeing big budget spectacles, things like War of the Worlds and King Kong, and we're seeing those films make a lot of money. But we're also seeing smaller films, things like Brokeback Mountain and Broken Flowers and Capote. And these films are sort of appealing to a more thoughtful audience that wants to think about these issues.
Well, David Edelstein, Professor Dixon used this word a couple of times, escapism. That's the way most of us perhaps think about going to the movies, not so much as a direct confrontation with tragedy or
horror.
Well,
that is a problem. That is a problem with telling the story, because let's face it, the mastermind of this, Osama bin Laden, is still at large. This is not a story that ends happily, even though the passengers on board United 93 did manage to stop that plane. They all died. The reason I have trouble seeing this as exploitation is that if you want to make an exploitation movie, you make King Kong. You don't tell the story of United 93. Remember, Pearl Harbor was made into a movie a few years ago under the auspices of Jerry Bruckheimer, and it didn't end with the smoldering wreckage of those ships and all the dead bodies. It actually ended with Jimmy Doolittle taking a squadron and bombing the hell out of Tokyo. You know, it's like, yeah, we're going to give it back to him. You know, Americans have a rather hard time with that sort of downbeat story, at least in the multiplex.
Professor Dixon, you wanted to jump in?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, I should make it clear that although I'm now here in Lincoln, Nebraska, I'm a native New Yorker. I mean, I was born in New Jersey, but I lived much of my time in New York and lived there till I came here. I wanted to make it clear that, you know, I'm not saying that Greengrass's film is exploitational. I'm saying that's something we should guard against. That basically that there are a lot of people who would jump in to make a traditional action movie, you know. And I think there's also another issue to jump in here, and that is that being careful about showing the violence in a way can be a trap, because I think that we have to acknowledge that those people died, and that they died horribly, that they basically gave their lives in defense of something they believed in. So I think that we have a twin problem here, and that is basically
right.
That you don't want to overshow the thing, but you don't want to play it down too much.
Well, on the other hand, I think we're somewhat inured to violence on the screen, and
I'd
we're
agree.
Also very prepared for it. And so what happens in United 93 that's extraordinary is the violence isn't so upsetting as much as the final phone calls of the passengers to their families.
The
I love yous, the goodbyes. That's when the theater that I saw it with, everyone broke out into sobs. And of course I was at the premiere and sitting in front of the families, and you can only imagine what it must have been like for them to watch conversations that in some cases reenacted, that in some cases were with them.
All right, we'll
No, I understand. It's totally faithful. I'm just saying that there's a danger the material can be exploited by less scrupulous filmmakers.
Okay.
I agree.
All right, we'll see what happens with this film and the others to come. Wheeler Winston Dixon and David Edelstein, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, the major developments of the day. The UN deadline for Iran to stop enriching uranium came and went. President Bush said the world is united in its concern about Iran's nuclear plans. But on the NewsHour this evening, Iran's UN ambassador said his government could be a willing partner in nuclear talks under the right circumstances. And another American soldier was killed in Iraq. That made April the deadliest month this year for U.S. forces, with 67 dead. Washington Week can be seen on most PBS stations later this evening. We'll see you online and again here Monday evening. Have a nice weekend. I'm Jim Lehrer. Thank you and good night.
Major funding for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer has been provided by...
What does the future hold? Will you have the choices to make your world better? To live the life you dream of?
At Pacific Life, planning for a better tomorrow is what we're all about. That's why for over 135 years, Pacific Life has offered millions of people a world of financial solutions to help them live well now and plan well for the future. Pacific Life, the power to help you succeed.
Sometimes success needs to be nurtured. Sometimes it wants to be pushed. Sometimes success takes everything we can give and then demands more. And sometimes all it takes is someone who sees what you see. At CIT, we're in the business of financing great ideas so you can take yours all the way to the top.
And by the Archer Daniels Midland Company, Toyota, and the Atlantic Philanthropies. And
this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Who do you trust to tell all sides of a story? Who do you trust to let different voices be heard? Who do you trust to teach your children? Who do you trust to help make sense of it all? Americans trust PBS more than any other television network.
Purchase video cassettes of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Call 1-866-678-NEWS.
Local underwriting is provided by Stanford Hospital and Clinics, with over 50 specialty clinics and more than 900 physicians, all using the latest technologies and treatments. More information on Stanford's experience and expertise is on the web at stanfordhospital.com. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, about 3 minutes, we'll have Marketplace.
The horseshoe crab is one of the oldest species on Earth, and recently it's being harvested as bait. Well, this has decreased the crab population and affected other species which depend upon the horseshoe crab for their survival. I'm Jim Metzner, and this is the Pulse of the Planet. Each May on the beaches of Delaware Bay, hordes of horseshoe crabs bury their eggs in the sand. During this spawning period, thousands of migrating shorebirds stop at the beach to feed on the eggs. Mike Haramis is a wildlife biologist.
Well, the issue in Delaware Bay is that there is now a commercial interest in harvesting horseshoe crabs. It's put a great demand on the horseshoe crabs. Basically, you can get a dollar a piece for these big gravid females just simply picking them up on the beach and throwing them in the back of your pickup truck. So millions of horseshoe crabs have apparently been harvested over the last half decade.
To help save the horseshoe crab, scientists have had to show that the crabs are an important part of the food web in Delaware Bay.
Well, what we're trying to do is to show that the horseshoe crab eggs are the main part of the diet of shorebirds. And I think that's a relatively clear picture when you visit Delaware Bay in May and you see hundreds of thousands of shorebirds eating crab eggs.
According to Mike Haramis, the shorebirds rely on crab eggs to provide them with enough energy to continue their migratory flight to the Arctic Circle. By analyzing the shorebirds' blood, scientists have determined that the crabs are an important part of the birds' diet, and if the horseshoe crabs become extinct, it's likely that the same thing will happen to the birds. Well, the research has paid off. Legislation is now in place that protects horseshoe crabs from being over-harvested. Pulse of the Planet is presented by the National Science Foundation. I'm Jim Metzner.
It's a minute before 4 o'clock. Let's get a look at Bay Area traffic from Dana Fields at Metro Traffic Control. Good afternoon, Dana.
Good afternoon, Brian. We just got a fresh look at a problem in Sonoma County, adding up to delays more so than usual for your Friday getaway on northbound 101. It's a crash at Sierra Avenue in Cotati, and it's in the center divider. Slowing your ride through Pleasanton, it's a stalled bus on East 580 before you get to Santa Rita Road. It's blocking the left-hand lane. And there's a stall on the Dumbarton Bridge, West 84, at about mid-span, blocking the right lane. Dana Fields for KQED Radio.
Thank you, Dana. That report was brought to you by Wyeth. Local underwriting is provided by City National Bank, providing complete financial solutions to California entrepreneurs, their businesses, and their families for over 50 years. City National Bank, the way up, on the web at cnb.com. This is KQED.